Bureau sharing weekend events. Downtown Bloomington's First Friday, Blessings of the Table at the David Davis Mansion, and Children's Discovery Museum, Dia de los Muertos on Saturday. Details at visitbn.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Hear why veterans might want to go to the new VA clinic on Hamilton Road instead of elsewhere in Bloomington Normal.
We are in communication very frequently with our partners of the Veterans Benefit side of the house, as well as the National Cemetery Administration. So we have all of the resources.
Melissa Spady with the VA tells Eric Sock about the $6 million renovation. Plus, hear from two writers from Normal who will be featured at this weekend's local author fair, and from a woman on the front lines of the fight for more representation in the STEM fields.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Thousands of veterans in McLean and nearby counties will soon have closer access to health care from a Veterans Affairs facility in Bloomington. The VA has converted a former unemployment office on Hamilton Road into an outpatient clinic in a $6 million renovation. The clinic will offer mental health, primary care, lab, and pharmaceutical services for veterans. Melissa Spady with the VA tells WGLT's Eric Stock, until now, most Bloomington Normal veterans had to drive an hour or more to access VA care.
So we recognized that there was a gap within our catchment area, and this area within McLean County and the surrounding counties, it's enriched with veterans, especially those younger veterans as well, you know, those that attend the local colleges and universities here. So it made perfect sense for us to put this clinic in the Bloomington Normal area.
Do you know how many veterans were going elsewhere from McLean County for health care to, say, Peoria, Mattoon, elsewhere?
So we know that there are around 20,000 eligible veterans within this area, and we really want to capitalize on all of those veterans, especially those veterans that have sought care outside of the VA. So we're really ramping up our outreach efforts, getting the word out about all of our VA services and what sets us apart from those non-VA care facilities.
Now, they were able to still go to those non-VA care facilities on their existing insurance, right?
Absolutely. So every veteran, they can decide which clinic that they want to go to. So, you know, we are all about bringing the access to care closer to the veterans. So that's why we are so proud to have this clinic here, so we can provide that access a lot closer to home for those veterans that reside here.
And what would you say are the specific advantages? Let's say they do have another place they can go in Bloomington Normal. Why should they come here instead?
Well, you know, not only our quality of care for the VA that we are extremely proud of, but our staff definitely recognizes the needs of the veterans. We provide, you know, just tremendous world-class care. We are in communication very frequently with our partners of the Veterans Benefit side of the house, as well as the National Cemetery Administration. So we have all of the resources collectively to service the veteran as a whole.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Melissa Spady, Acting Public Affairs Officer for the VA Ileana Healthcare System, as the new VA facility will be opening in Bloomington here shortly. And as you alluded to, mental health is one of the aspects that the VA facility here will be helping to address. Many veterans return from the battlefield with post-traumatic stress disorder, the psychological scars of being on the battlefield. Can you explain specifically what the VA does to address mental health in its patients?
Sure. So, you know, we are here at the ready. Any veteran that comes in crisis, we will take them in. We will ensure that they are taken care of immediately. Our staff are highly trained in the mental health procedures and protocols to assist those veterans. We are capable of being there for those veterans in need and in crisis.
And looking at the Veterans Affairs Office at the national level, there had been benefits that were delayed because of some software issues. It affected about 27,000 beneficiaries. Have you encountered any veterans in the Ileana healthcare system that have had to deal with this issue?
There are a few veterans, a time or two, that come up. But again, we deal with those veterans on a case-by-case basis, and we ensure that those issues are rectified and we get them connected to the appropriate resources within our VA system as a whole.
There had also been a delay of some disability benefits, I understand, from some Vietnam veterans who had contracted Agent Orange until January after President Trump had authorized those benefits in June. Do you know where those stand at this point?
I don't have the personal knowledge of that. That is on the veteran benefit side of the house, the VBA. But again, if there's any veteran in need or needing more assistance on that, we do offer telebenefit services, so we can connect those veterans with the VB side of the house. And again, you know, if the veterans, even though they're not coming here necessarily for health, but if they need updates when it comes to their benefits or wanting more information about cemetery benefits, we can link them up appropriately. We have the contacts to get them those questions answered.
And going back to the mental health realm, this is an issue that has come up in McLean County, where there's a bit of discussion of a veterans court to assist veterans navigate the court system when they have issues arise. And a challenge that they've encountered is there is this mindset of self-responsibility of, I don't need anybody else's help, I've got this under control, when maybe they do need help. Do you encounter that? And is there a way to get to that veteran to help them understand that they can use your assistance?
Absolutely. So I think the most important thing is to instill that trust into the veterans. So once we bring them in and they meet with their provider or even social worker, we hope to establish that trust and provide that care and those resources. And the most important thing is that we follow up with that veteran. Maybe they don't need our services today, but if we follow up with them in the near future, hopefully they will eventually come back and they will see that we are here for them. And we want to provide the care that they deserve.
Have you encountered that at all, that mindset that you've had to sort of break through?
Absolutely. You know, some are harder than others, but it's very rewarding to see once we finally break through with those veterans that they looked at us in the past and now they're coming back around. And, you know, we're a different VA than perhaps what your grandfather went 2 years ago. And to really get that message out to all of our veterans, both younger veterans as well as older veterans, is so important. And we just want them to come in and see what we're about and give us a try. And hopefully they'll be happy, and again, instilling that trust in the veterans.
And do you feel that mindset has changed over time across generations based on perceptions that many Americans had of those who have served our country, you know, going back to the Vietnam War, to the Gulf War, Iraq, Afghanistan, et cetera?
Absolutely. I've definitely seen that firsthand. I attend a lot of outreach events, and we will have Vietnam veterans come to us, and they'll tell us, you know, I wish I would have signed up for this years ago, and I'm so happy with the care, and we have just done a remarkable job in servicing them and helping them. And they say, you know, I'm going to tell my nieces, my nephews, my grandchildren that are now in the service that they need to come here, because a lot of these veterans we have saved their lives, and they have completely turned their lives around utilizing our services.
And as we continue on Sound Ideas with Melissa Spady, the Acting Public Affairs Officer for the VA Ileana Healthcare System, ahead of the outpatient clinic site opening in Bloomington in early November. Looking at another national issue, the VA has been working for years to digitize its patient health records, and we understand that is a monumental task. There have been reports in the media in recent years about a major data backlog. Do you have an idea of how that is being improved? Is that being chipped away? Is that being reduced, and is that impacting patients at the local level at all?
I would have to say, we receive updates from National, from VACO, of course, how we are working towards the modernization of the electronic medical record. But again, at the end of the day, you know, any veteran that presents with any specific issues or any issues with backlog, we connect them with the appropriate appropriate partner within the VA to assist them to the best that we can.
And have you been hearing feedback from veterans in the community about having this option available that they've not had until now?
Not too much. Occasionally when we go out to our veteran town hall events, they will mention, every veteran wants to have updates on what's going on with electronic modernization or the Agent Orange, so on and so forth. So having these events, bringing forth any updates that we have on a national level is very much important. I mean, we want to know just as much as the veterans want to know about any of these updates.
That was Melissa Spady from the VA speaking with WGLT's Eric Stock. The clinic's open house is next Thursday, November 7th from 3 to 4. Spady says the clinic will have staff on hand to help veterans with eligibility and enrollment questions. The clinic is tentatively scheduled to open November 18th. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Fox & Hounds Hair Salon and Day Spa, helping you create your most beautiful look with salon services for hair and nails, facial, deep tissue, stone and relaxation massage, and waxing and sugaring. A full list of services at fox-n-hounds.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Candace Hulbert loves her job, but as a scientific associate at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, she says she's often the only woman and person of color in the room. Hulbert tells WGLT's Mary Cullen about how she encourages children from underrepresented groups to pursue careers in STEM.
As the only woman sometimes, or even a person of color, it's more noticeable if I did something wrong versus somebody else. You know, it's just always being under that pressure to make sure that I'm always performing well. So then that way, you know, you don't want to give minorities or black folks or women a bad name just because, you just can't be you, I guess you can say sometimes. You don't have that freedom. You're always thinking about that. That's always in your mind.
How does society even begin to address that? You know, what can be done to be better?
Becoming aware of it is number one. So, you know, realizing that the people that are sitting at the table making all these decisions all look the same is number one. So if you can become aware and become aware of the biases and the systematic biases that are put into place, then you can start to at least address it. So if a person continues to ignore the fact that the room all looks the same, then they don't care that anything needs to be done about it. They're happy, and it's fine. And so, you know, I was just watching this article, this video about, you know, being comfortable with being uncomfortable. And that's what people have to do, is to get out of their comfort zone and challenge their own self about, you know, increasing diversity in thought and diversity in the way that you would go about your daily lives, basically. And so to realize your own biases, you can overcome them at the end. And then put your money where your mouth is at the end of the day. I mean, in reality, businesses will put millions and millions of dollars into products, but they, when it's time to hire a person, they all of a sudden don't have the money to do it. So the thing is that we need to be intentional about recruiting at these companies, and also know that because you hire a diverse candidate, so a candidate from, you know, underserved community, does not mean that doesn't equate to somebody that's not qualified. So you still will hire the most qualified person, but you should also make sure you're being intentional about finding those correct people.
What initially drew your interest in STEM, knowing that there is this lack and knowing that maybe the peers that look most like you weren't pursuing the same things? What made you want to do it?
I wanted to make a lot of money. That is the biggest thing. So I knew when I was younger, I wanted to be a doctor. And Dr. Sapora, who's still at in the chemistry department at Illinois State, she asked me to do undergraduate research with her. So I said, sure, why not? And that is what introduced me to, you know, independent research, basically. And so that's kind of what led me into STEM. But I always enjoyed science. Even as a little girl, I loved science. But what kept me motivated was the fact that, you know, my friends were all really proud of me that I was this the chemistry major. So I've always kind of been the unicorn in the room where, you know, he had his black girl from Chicago who didn't go to the best high school in the city, who wasn't the smartest person in the class. I didn't get some extremely high score on my ACT or SAT. But I worked really hard. I'm a hard worker. And I'm motivated. When I put my mind to something, I'm going to do it. And I felt like back in those days, I was extremely ambitious. And I felt like if people might not want me to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway because I'm going to prove them that I can.
Thinking about today's youth, whose responsibility is it to foster an interest in STEM for them?
I think it's the community. I really do. I believe that it's our job as scientists and engineers now to go back into the community and work with the youth. I remember when I was in high school, I had a math teacher ask a question one day in class, and I answered it, and he's like, "Yeah, that's right." He's like, "You know, you think like an engineer, you should be an engineer." And at the time, an engineer to me was a person that drove trains. And I'm like, why the heck would he tell me to be an engineer? I'm not driving trains. Like, you know, had I known what an engineer was, I probably would have actually majored in chemical engineering. And so if youth, especially from underserved communities, don't see people that look like them in those jobs and don't know that these jobs exist, then they never pursue it. And anybody, for that matter, you know, if you think about when you were a child, what you wanted to be, you probably wanted to be something that either your parents were or what you saw around you. So that's why you have so many kids say they want to be teachers or they want to be doctors or they want to be lawyers and things like that, because those are the professions we know about as children. Nobody really talks about electrical engineering. Nobody really talks about mechanical engineering or what a chemist may do or what an astrophysicist is. You still have people say, oh, I want to be an astronaut. Well, they are astrophysicists. So that's the thing. And unless you have that out there, you know, you get people that say, oh, I want to create video games. Well, those are computer scientists. And unless you know specifically about those jobs and what they do, you will never know to pursue that career.
Now, I think that ties in well with the nonprofit that you established, Yo STEM, or mm-hmm. Youth Outreach in Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics.
Yep.
So your nonprofit works with underserved communities to address the lack of diversity in STEM. So how exactly are you living out those goals that you mentioned of, you know, getting involved in the community and really encouraging students to pursue STEM? How are you doing that through your nonprofit?
What we do is we are an after-school program, and we wanted to provide a safe space for young ladies to be themselves and learn science and do experiments at the same time. And then also to show them that we look like you and we are all STEM professionals in our own different ways. And so in our own different fields. And so and then that will inspire them, you know, to pursue it if that's what they choose to do. And so we would do different types of experiments, whether it was chemistry. We've done some college-level experiments, so we've determined the amount of aspirin in the aspirin tablet. We had one young lady that was a mechanical engineer, so she had them designing and making little motorized buggies. They've done hovercrafts out of, like, styrofoam plates and things like that. They've learned about flow and shear based on particle size from our material scientists. We are basically like the lab of the school. So that's kind of where we are. We just really want to build these lasting relationships with these young people to guide them along the way. And so one of my girls, her response was, you know, I asked her about her opinion of the program, and she said, you know, she came to us as an eighth grader, so she said she was already on track to go into STEM, but seeing the women coming let her know that she could do it.
WGLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Candace Halbert, a scientific associate at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Halbert is the keynote speaker at ISU's Charles Morris STEM Social for Underrepresented Students next week. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, making an impact one grant at a time. Applications accepted October 1st through 31st for youth programs and those improving the lives of women and girls. Details at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Tomorrow marks the start of National Novel Writing Month, or NaNoWriMo, as the cool kids call it. The goal is to encourage amateur writers, including first-timers, to write 50,000 words of a book throughout the month of November. To mark the occasion, the Bloomington Public Library will host a local author fair this coming Sunday. I spoke to two authors from Normal, Melissa Davis and Sue Rovins, about their craft. Davis's first published book, Land of the Shadows, was actually written as a National Novel Writing Month project.
You kind of fly by the seat of your pants when you're writing like a National Novel Writing Month book, because you're told not to think too hard, to write as fast as you can, and then go back and edit later. So write, then go back and edit, and you edit like, man, you could edit forever. It's never perfect, no matter how many times you keep going over it. So That's how I got started with the book writing. But you know, it's been a lifetime journey, reading until I couldn't find anything that I wanted to read anymore. So I started writing my own books, because back then we didn't have young adult. We only had children and adult. There was nothing in between. So I was in that point where I wanted to have something else to get lost in, and that's when I got lost in writing.
That's one of the reasons why the Bloomington Public Library does the local author fairs, to piggyback on National Novel Writing Month. And so that's what you did with the first book that you published, with Land of the Shadows. What is Land of the Shadows about?
The Land of the Shadows, we've all kind of experienced it when everything's going right and then you get these thoughts in your head. And it's like the shadows that are like these things that rise up from the ground. It's like a paranormal fantasy, basically, where this time of year, especially around Halloween, it seems to get a little darker with the light fading with no more sunlight. And so people start to get those thoughts like everything could be perfect one minute, and the next minute everything is just not okay. And you're trying to figure out where it comes from. And so the shadows are basically these entities that are coming up from the ground and trying to put these evil thoughts in your head and take control over you. And the whole story is about witches that are trying to defeat the shadows. So,
and we're joined in studio here by Sue Rovins of Normal, another local author. You write suspense.
Yes, I do.
Can you tell me about your first experience writing a novel, writing a whole book?
My first book was actually a book of short stories, In a Corner Darkly, Volume 1. And there's 15 short stories in that particular one. I wrote that in 2009. And then 3 years later, I started my first novel, which is Bad Fish, and that was actually based on me seeing a sign. We were driving somewhere, and there was a sign, Bad Fish Creek, and I loved that name so much, I knew I had to put a book behind that name.
Well, what is your process for writing? Where do you do it? When do you do it? Are you doing it among other people? Are you locked away in a small room by yourself?
That's if I could be locked away, that would be about as good as it would get. I don't write in a group. I can't really go to, like you said, a coffee house and write. It has to be deadly quiet. I even push the cats away if I have to. I do a lot with NaNoWriMo as well. That's where my three novels began. I use it as a draft, basically, to get 50,000 words. And then in about 3 or 4 months from then, I will go back and start the editing process.
So in National Novel Writing Month, kind of the gimmick or the shtick is that you are encouraged to write 50,000 words over the course of a month. Having both done this this exercise before, is that kind of a good amount of, is that a good word count? Is that reachable for a first timer? Is that a good place to start?
I think a first timer might actually get very frustrated. When I first started it, I thought there's no way I'm going to get to 50,000 words. And it really is about like close to 1,700 words a day that you have to write. And so I would just say that anybody who is trying to do it, don't worry about whether or not you make that goal. Count every word you do, celebrate every word, every paragraph. It doesn't matter if you get there. The progress is just moving along and just pushing yourself through regardless. So, I mean, there's been times I have not made that goal. They do it in summer, and I've been like, okay, I got halfway there because I just had too much going on. I mean, life happens. So you have to celebrate every word you get, no matter if it's only 10 for the day. Like, okay, I got 10 words. Then you'd be excited about that, because otherwise you're going to get stuck.
What has the publishing process been like for you? Are you self-publishing? Are you working through a traditional publisher? What has that been like?
I'm a self-published author. I have a press now called Plump Toad Press. For me and how I write my books, I don't really want someone else telling me how to write it, how to finish it, how to create characters or change this scene. The stories that I write, I work very hard, and they're very personal stories. And I really push the character development and the plot as opposed to just filler. And I don't want someone saying, your book has to be 80,000 words instead of 50,000. You know, if I can tell a story in 50,000, then, you know, there it is.
And as a self-publisher, or what are the things that you do to make sure that your work finds an audience?
It's constant. Always be selling. Always. You never know who's going to buy it. You never know who's going to like it. I do a lot of local events. I go to author fairs like this one coming up at Bloomington Public Library on Sunday. I've gone to Chicago, Rockford, St. Louis area, just kind of a host of different things. I also have a blog where I interview authors of all genres. Because of that, other people come to read what their friends are doing, and then they might poke around my blog and see what I'm doing. So it kind of helps everybody. So that kind of connection to make with other authors, other venues, it's, again, it's all about always be selling.
And Melissa Davis, also another author from Normal, what has been your experience like on the publishing side?
On the publishing side, actually, I am involved with a small publishing press called World Castle Publishing out of Pensacola, Florida. And my publisher is amazing because she's smaller, and it's more like an independent publishing than like the big six that everybody's trying to get into. So there is a lot more freedom in what you write. And but I know what you mean, but they have certain formulas you have to follow, and, you know, certain covers they want. And if you have a different vision for what you want, then you have to really kind of pull your teeth out. Like, you just, it's really hard. But with a smaller independent one like I have, I have a lot more say in what's done with my books, and I have somebody who truly believes in us and is trying to help us. So I've done self-publishing too. There's so much involved. I know how to format my books. I have editors. I make my own covers. Like, there's so much involved in that whole process. It's so funny when people ask you for free books, and they get mad at you because they want to, you need money for what you've done. You put so much time and effort, and they just want it free. And like, there's a lot of pirating, especially with electronic books. And it just makes me so mad, because they have no idea. It's not like we just woke up and boom, we wrote a book. Like, there's so much more involved in it. The writing part's the easy part. That is the easiest part. It doesn't sound easy, but that is the easiest part, because there's so much involved in, with the formatting, knowing where you put your page bleeds. If you're doing like a physical book, like, you have to figure that out. But a lot of the things, like the NaNoWriMo, they actually will connect you with like CreateSpace or other places that will help you publish your book. They have resources on their website too. So like, even if you're thinking about doing it, you're like, oh man, I don't know, the editing might be so hard to find, and the formatter and all the picture stuff for the covers, like, I don't know how to do any of that. They have a lot of resources on there that can help you. So I would take advantage of it if it's something you're wanting to try out, for sure. But yeah, it's a long process either way, because there is a lot of editing involved, whether you like, for us, we do several rounds of edits back and forth with the editor before we actually put it out. So it's not like somebody just takes your book and says, here it is, you're done. Like, no, you have to keep going back and forth. And that still doesn't guarantee that it's perfect. Like, I've caught errors in like big name authors, and I'm like, wait, how did that get through there? I mean, nobody is perfect, but it's definitely a process.
That's Melissa Davis and Sue Rovins, two authors from Normal who will be featured at the 3rd Annual Local Author Fair on Sunday, November 3rd from 2 to 4 p.m. at Bloomington Public Library. It's free and open to the public. This is Sound Ideas. You can lend a hand, a helping hand to neighborhood wildlife with some extra food and water this winter, and in return, enjoy the variety of feathered and furry friends that come for a visit. In this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow, Illinois State University's Patrick Murphy shares some do's and don'ts with WGLT's Mike McCurdy when it comes to feeding wildlife.
Cold weather months can be tough for wildlife, but you can help, and you may attract a variety of birds and critters to your yard. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert, Patrick Murphy, from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Murphy, you staying warm?
We're enjoying this weather change. It's great. It's beautiful here in central Illinois.
It's a little chilly for my taste, but this is the time of year when we should think about taking care of our feathered friends and our furry friends that come to our backyards. We're talking about the added benefit of having a suburban or rural place, the opportunity to attract and care for wildlife. And I guess it's important to remember this is wildlife, not domesticated animals.
That's right, and you want to treat them as so. Use caution in exposing your pets and family members to the birds and animals that you're trying to help take care of.
The bird seed and any food we provide is a bonus for wildlife because they know how to forage for food.
That's right, and table scraps are off the list, you know, so the bird seed and the suet and the little frozen peanut butter things that we put out for the squirrels and the rabbits, that's kind of as far as you're supposed to go with people food. Old loaves of bread and stuff like that, you're not encouraged to feed that to the birds. Matter of fact, the coyotes and foxes probably get a lot of that stuff too.
And can they become dependent on that?
Okay. I think that they can in the fact that some of the animals, like the turkeys, they become territorial. Mm. And I know that's true too for the foxes and coyotes. They cover so much land in a day, it's just mind-boggling. But they do keep coming back to the same areas if they've encountered ease of feeding.
And if we cut that off, they could have an issue if they've become dependent upon it.
I think that they do. I've heard situations with this raccoons. I've had that personal experience where we stop feeding the birds and the wildlife near our back porch, only to find the coons left us a little poo pile surprise. Can't eat there, so, you might as well poo there, I guess, if you're a raccoon.
Or maybe it's a poo protest.
I think it is.
So I mentioned suburban and rural places. What kind of difference might we see when comparing a backyard in Normal and a backyard in rural McLean County as it concerns birds and wildlife?
I think the rural locations are closer to larger habitat areas, so you might get a bigger mix compared to you know, somebody that's within city limits. You might get the usuals, you know, you might get the cardinal, you might get the squirrels and the rabbits and the wood ducks, but you might not get the turkeys unless you're closer to the larger habitat area.
Well, everyone is familiar, I think, at this point with the wild turkeys that were roaming around Normal last year. I saw them in my neighborhood, but never in my backyard. You mentioned turkeys can be territorial. Can wildlife sort of move in and make themselves at home and not go away? Maybe you don't want them there.
I know a family that's been taking care of a duck for a long time, that the duck that doesn't leave in the winter, you know, he's just hanging around. So he's hanging around because there's plenty to eat there. And I think that that's the double-edged sword. It's also the point of view to keep in mind. And when you're, you know, tempted to throw out that old bag of oyster crackers because the ducks will, they'll eat them, and then they might have diarrhea to the extent that they're dehydrated, and then they're vulnerable in the cold, and then they don't want to leave. Mm-hmm. So you might be interfering with nature's way. But I don't know that the animals just immediately set up shop there because they have gotten some food necessarily.
I love seeing the birds in my backyard. We feed the squirrels whole ears of corn. They seem to like that. Everybody seems to get enough food. I don't see a lot of fights, but occasionally I see some birds hanging around that maybe some people would be uncomfortable with. I mean, I feel a little guilty when I see a hawk pick off a bird in my backyard, but I figure hawks have to eat too.
Yeah, nature can be cruel, right? But it's just, that's the way of nature that happens, and we don't want to interfere with that. We just part of observing the beauty of nature and wildlife.
I kind of feel like I'm providing a smorgasbord for a Cooper's hawk.
I've wondered that too, you know, especially with the little, we have like a water saucer. It's not actually a bird bath. It's just a drip tray that we keep filled with water. So it's easy to keep clean. And we've noticed that the hawks sometimes use that as an opportunity. And we've even had a year that the hawk would sit inside of a large container display, right up by the house. Mm. So it was attractive enough to them that the animal took a risk in putting itself close to humans.
I always know a hawk's in my backyard because everything goes really, really quiet.
They're still beautiful, yeah. though.
So is this a good point to bring up maybe bird feeder and bird bath or water source placement? If it's near shrubs or under trees, that makes it harder for the hawk to sort of dive in and get the bird.
That's true. And with all the design guidelines for those items set aside, I think you got to understand that the birds and most of the wild animals, they're relieving themselves where they feed. And so you want to keep that away from where your pets might go out when you let them out for their night, for last nightly outing. And also, too, the byproduct of those seeds that lands on the ground, it can turn into a headache for you in the form of unwanted plants or weeds. But you can set yourself up to succeed by knowing that and having a good selection of seed that has a low chance of germinating or has a low content percentage of weed seeds. And that's something you can find typically on the label of bird seed.
Every spring I have sunflowers come up. I sort of thin them out, but let some of them go. And then the birds eat the seeds right out of the heads.
Well, and that reminds me, Mike, some people that I've encountered over the years that are vegetable gardeners, they place the bird feed with the sunflower and stuff like that in their garden or near their garden, because to have a few sunflowers popping up in the spring isn't such a bad thing, is it? Because they need that too. The pollinators need those sunflowers for a place to eat and to help spread the pollen.
And along the lines of bird feeder placement, what about how high it is off the ground? Is there a recommended height?
Well, if you notice the actual bird baths that you see for sale all over the place, they're 24 to 30 inches off the ground. I think that it was originally motivated by how deep can the snow get, you know, so you want it to be up above the snow. I have not seen a snow that deep in central Illinois in a long time. But if you lived in North Dakota or somewhere in Wisconsin, yeah, sure, it might get that high. And that has something to do with how high you hang the feeder. Also, times you can hang the feeder in not only at a proper height, but in a manner that will discourage some of the ground critters from just raiding the cabinets, basically.
Do we go a little crazy with sort of fall and winter cleanup, you know, hygiene in the garden? If we left the coneflowers up all winter or left the sunflowers up all winter until the seeds were gone, doesn't that benefit wildlife? It also gives them some cover, too, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I do like the notion of being selective and a little less detail-oriented on your cleanups. I'm not an advocate of doing nothing is doing something. That just doesn't make sense to me. I've seen the robins pass through the landscape here on campus and at my house, and they turn over the leaves on the ground. They're looking for something that's sought shelter or raised from the soil under those leaves. So leaving a few leaves around is not the worst thing to do. Leaving your perennials to stand, particularly the coneflower and the natives, I think that's a great idea, not only because it provides some forage and cover, but a lot of those native plants have awesome winter character. The black stems, the dried up seed heads of the echinacea, like you mentioned, and it's all still there for the ground critters and the flying animals.
And the finches eat those coneflower seeds. I see them perched on there all the time. So water, I've heard water is more important than food. Is that true?
That's my understanding, is that we can, if you really got a soft heart for the animals in nature, it's the water that they need a little help with. And that can be a challenge, right? Because it can freeze.
So you need a bird bath warmer or something that's going to keep it thawed.
It's going to require some maintenance, yeah, for sure.
If you have any questions about taking care of wildlife or anything in the garden, submit them at WGLT.org/grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with ISU's Patrick Murphy. Submit your gardening questions to WGLT.org/grow.
And you could subscribe to this podcast and our daily news podcast, The Leadoff, at WGLT.org. Our next story is a bit of a spooky one, perfect for Halloween. What happens when even a scientist can't find a scientific explanation for seemingly supernatural events? WGLT correspondent Brianna Groh has more from this month's Next to Paranormal Story Slam.
Kevin Wickert was raised as a preacher's kid, then later became a scientist. So it's ironic and maybe even fitting that he's had more than a few visits from beyond the veil.
My family and I live in a haunted house. These experiences have been going on for a while. They run the gamut from unexplained noises, smells, other sensations, to lights turning on and off, doors opening and closing without any obvious help, all the way to things like apparitions and objects moving while we're watching them. This actually goes back a ways. As far as both my wife and I can remember, we have always had experiences like this back to our childhood. But when we got married, it seemed to amplify things rather. And these experiences since then have continued through nearly 37 years, 5 different residences in 3 different towns. So it's probably more accurate to say that we don't live in a haunted house as much as we do a haunted life.
Wickert says he had trouble deciding which story to share at the Next to Paranormal Story Slam, so he called up a friend for help.
As I was telling these encounters to my friend, one of the questions he asked me after, "Are you insane?" Was, "How can you be so nonchalant about this?" That was what he found most fascinating, and I had to agree with him. I talk about this in the same tone that I would talk about lawn care.
That made Wickert wonder, how did the paranormal get to be just normal?
I'm going to set the Wayback Machine for 1987. My wife and I had been married for about 3 years. We were living in a 2-bedroom flat with our son, who was a toddler at the time. This was not our first experience, but it was certainly a watershed event for us. We had had a few lesser experiences up till that point, but nothing really significant until one night our son had awakened because his drink bottle was empty. So while I settled him down, my wife goes into the kitchen to refill it. A moment later, she comes tearing out of the kitchen, followed almost immediately by a crash. She flattens herself against the wall in the hallway. She is chalk white. Now, I think you've all probably seen like a horror movie or a monster movie where somebody faces the monster and they are so terrified they cannot talk. If you thought that that was like a Hollywood invention, it's not. I have seen it in action. My wife, I'm trying, "What's wrong?" And she's, all she could do was point into the kitchen. So I go into the kitchen and I look, and there's the full bottle on the counter, and I look, and there between the refrigerator and the countertop is lying on the floor is a broken bottle of corn syrup. I'm sorry it wasn't something more terrifying, okay? Like a human skull or a portal to hell. But not only the paranormal is not only camera shy, it has no sense of dramatic narrative, okay? This was a bottle of corn syrup. That's what had made the crash. Well, when I took the bottle to our son, that was done, and I finally got my wife calmed down enough to tell me what had happened. She had gone in, refilled the bottle, put the milk back in the refrigerator. As she was straightening up, she caught movement out of the corner of her eye, and she turns, and the first thing she sees is the upper cabinet, our baking cabinet, door closing. The second thing she sees is the bottle of corn syrup in midair, just hanging there, not moving. That was when she left, and that was the crash that I'd heard. And so I started thinking, well, what might have caused that? So, of course, I make my wife come back into the kitchen and tell me, okay, where was the bottle? Well, I went through all the scenarios. You know, being trained as a scientist, you try to look for the scientific explanation. In order for that bottle to get where it had been, I thought, well, maybe there was just like a momentary tremor and it fell out of the cabinet. And except that for two things. First of all, based on where the cabinet was and where she saw that bottle, I found it 3 feet to the side of where it had been, where she had seen it. Secondly, that bottle had been at the back of that cabinet with a bunch of other things in front of it. So in order for it to get out of there in the first place, it had to come up, turn sideways, and come out. Now, fast forward to a few months ago when my wife came back from running errands and she walks into the house, different house now, the one we're in currently, and she walks in, and there in the middle of the living room is a half-gallon bottle of, I think it was humidifier conditioner, a foot and a half off the floor. This time she looks at it, goes, very nice, put it back down carefully, please. Down it goes. Now, granted, suffice to say that we're not surprised by much anymore.
Wickert says when people hear about his haunted life, they always ask, have you called Ghost Hunters?
My wife, we have been fans of the TV show Ghost Hunters for a long time. And they've been doing this for, 12 or 13 seasons. But what bothers me about a lot of these ghost hunting programs is that they are making judgments, they are collecting evidence and evaluating that evidence without recognizing the technology, without thinking beyond just the photo or the voice recording that they get and claiming it's paranormal, when if you understand how a camera works, or how a voice recorder works, or how, more to the point, a thermal imaging camera works, then suddenly that evidence doesn't seem quite so convincing.
So in those cases, the more knowledge you have about science and scientific processes, that sort of debunks that part of the supernatural. Have you ever tried yourself to explore whether there are certain entities that are trying to interact with you and your wife, and what have you found or not found?
We have. In pretty much every place we've lived, we've looked at the background of the house or the apartment, and as near as we were able to determine, there were no violent deaths in any of the places. The closest we ever came to that was the house we're currently in, which is owned by a friend of ours, and it belonged to her parents. Her parents both died while they owned the house, but not in it. We think, though, we pretty much have some evidence to suggest that they are among the entities that are in there. I sort of briefly mentioned a woman that appeared in the kitchen. When I pulled up a picture of our friend's mother that our friend had sent us, my wife walked by and saw me looking at it, and she goes, that's her. That's who I saw. I go, oh, that's our friend's mom. And she goes, oh, okay. So, and the actions that this apparition were going through was consistent with her mom's activities. So,
I'm sure you've considered at some point, what is it about us that draws these experiences to us? And have you come up with any kind of answer?
No. I know that in interviews, giving a one-word answer is not a good thing. But the fact is no, we don't. If we did know what it was that seemed to be drawing this activity, it wouldn't change a whole lot, but it might give us more clues into what exactly is going on.
Do you enjoy at all these interactions with the paranormal? Go ahead.
I do a lot more than my wife does, since she seems to be the focus of it. It certainly makes life more interesting. It's one of the things that has been said about paranormal experiences and the popularity of such things is that as people, we are looking for something to give us a sense of wonder. You know, in a world where science has basically quantified existence down to 3 decimal places, it's almost comforting to know that there are things that we haven't explained yet.
Despite decades of goings-on, Wickert still remains a skeptical believer. Lights on when he swore he turned them off, coffee not where he left it. Probably just a classic case of human error. I'm Brianna Groh.
You can hear more stories just like this by subscribing to our Next to Normal Story Slam podcast at WGLT.org. This is WGLT Normal 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.